We would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Preborn. When a mother meets her baby on an ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. But she can't do it without our help. Preborn needs us, the pro-life community, to come alongside her. One ultrasound is just $28. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby, or visit preborn.com.
Jenna Ellis in the morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview. The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our creator, not our government. I believe that scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the morning.
Good morning. Good morning and happy Friday. So we are a little over 2 weeks away from the 2024 election, finally, I think. And there are a lot of things on the ballot, as we've been discussing all week, that include not only the top of the ticket and, of course, the race between Donald Trump and Kamala Harris, but all the way down ticket for the House and Senate control in Washington, of course, states and state leadership, and ballot initiatives that are incredibly important, from everything to pro-life and abortion regulation, or cementing a so-called right to abortion in state constitutions, to things like ballot initiatives that are election integrity related, and some states actually having something similar to the SAVE Act on their ballot initiative that only U.S. citizens can vote in U.S. elections. I mean, imagine that. Those are things that should pass that are good. So there's a lot at stake in 2024. And among, you know, a lot of the of the conservatives, and of course we need to define what that term means, you know, people who understand America's founding being on a Judeo-Christian worldview, we have self-government, we have a limited government that is to promote freedom, liberty, and prosperity, and ensure that the rights that are God-given for every individual are protected, and that includes not only the things that are mentioned and enumerated in the Bill of Rights, but to understand that the powers not given to the federal or state governments are reserved to we the people to exercise, like healthcare, actual healthcare, decision-making, parental rights, what we choose to believe about God and how we discover truth, how we communicate. I mean, a lot of these things are left to us to determine in a well-ordered society. So there is a lot at stake here, and not just specific issues and not just Trump versus Harris, but overall where we are headed as a country and where the conservative movement overall is headed, especially whether Trump versus Harris wins, because there are a lot of people who have a lot of different ideas of where the country might be headed, maybe off a cliff, if one or the other gets elected or one or the other loses. So to join me to discuss all this and more is our very good friend Orrin McIntyre, who's a host and writer at The Blaze, and someone who I really love having more long-form conversations with, because you're just such a great intellectual mind, Orrin, and to bring up things that I think we should all consider in a broader understanding of the conservative philosophical movement. So thanks so much for joining me this morning.
Well, thanks for having me.
Yeah, so let's kind of start there with, you know, and in this first segment, let's talk first about conservatism overall and kind of define that a little bit. And then I want to get into your thoughts of where we're headed as a movement if Kamala Harris ends up in the White House. So first of all, how should the Christian conservative think about the conservative movement overall, not just party or, you know, GOP Republican affiliation, their platform, but understanding the meaning of conservatism as a concept? And, you know, we only have an hour here, but you know, if we can condense it down, you know, give us kind of your 30,000 foot perspective on that.
Well, you know, Russell Kirk wrote a book called The Conservative Mind, which I don't think gets enough weight today. And in there, he really talks about conservatism as non-ideological. And I think that's the first thing that conservatives need to take away from this. They tend to think of conservatism as a checklist of these are our values or our principles. And of course, there are values and principles involved in conservatism, but conservatism is not some abstract way to, you know, create a utopian ideology. That's the exact opposite of what it is. That's what the left does. The right, conservatives, they have a more organic understanding of what their society should be. And so when we think of conservatism, what we're conserving matters. It's not just the label conservative. You're not just a communist. You know, you don't just have this ideology, this abstract way you want humanity to work. You're operating from a tradition that is continuing out of the past, and you are part of that chain. You are handing that tradition from your past into the future. That's what you are conserving when you conserve. And so when we think about it, it's really important to remember that that is what we are doing. We are not just, you know, furthering an abstract ideology, but we are perpetuating a way of being, a system of values, beliefs, traditions, heritage, history, language, culture that all defines who we are and what we're doing. And so that puts us in a very difficult place because naturally, as conservatives, we look at the institutions of our society and we say, hey, I want to defend that, right? Like, I want to defend the school system. I want to defend the military. I want to defend, you know, the FBI, or I want to defend these organizations, because in a healthy society, the institutions are what perpetuate a large amount of those values, of that culture, of that religion, of that understanding. And so for conservatives, the natural inclination is to say, I need to protect these things because they are what define my society. But the problem for the right and many conservatives is that our institutions have been infiltrated and corrupted. They have betrayed us. And in many cases, they're doing exactly the opposite of what they're doing. They're supposed to. You know, our Department of Homeland Security doesn't seem to care very much about the security of our homeland. You know, our Defense Department doesn't defend America. It only defends foreign nations. We have a Department of Justice which isn't interested in justice, and a Department of Education that isn't interested in education. And so we're in a very difficult space because we want to conserve, we want to perpetuate that way of being, that understanding, those values and traditions and truths as we live them. But we also know we can't trust the institutions that are supposed to forward those. And so in many ways, the term conservative isn't even appropriate because we are not conserving the system as it exists now. What we want to do is restore, revivify. We want to bring forth what we believe, what we know was America, and we want to bring that into the future and make it something that is living again. But we can't conserve the current system and do that. And that's something that is a little, you know, abstract, I guess. It's a little theoretical for people, but I think it's an important mental shift because it puts us in the mode of builders, creators, instead of the mode of people who are just trying to hold up a system that actually has now been engineered to attack what we believe in.
Yeah, and I think that's such a brilliant explanation of conservatism and that building, because so much of the left, and when they say, well, we are for progress and for moving forward, they try to typecast conservatives as being the ones who are stagnated and are looking to the past and just restraining all of this forward momentum that the left is trying to push forward and be progressives. And so it matters how we view and how we articulate what conservatism is. And when you mention, you know, all of these institutions that have been captured and they're not actually working for the best interests of individual rights, liberties, and freedoms, this is why the top of the ticket matters in terms of the overall worldview that the majority of the country, at least in terms of the Electoral College count, and thankfully we still have the Electoral College, by the way, which is my podcast this week, On Demand with Jenna Ellis. We're doing a deep dive into the Electoral College, so make sure you go to AFR.net, click on the icon for podcasts, and listen to that when it drops today, and understand why we have the Electoral College instead of just the popular vote. But when we have, you know, approximately half the country that is wanting to install the nation's top leader in the White House that has a very fundamentally different view of the legitimacy of government and these institutions, like a Kamala Harris, then that portends something all the way down into states, into other offices. And that's why not just the power perspective, Orrin McIntyre, but this is why it really does typify where the country is headed. And so on that note, I mean, if Kamala Harris does win, and she is an avowed, self-described Marxist socialist, and we would, I think, rightly describe her as a communist in terms of her policy, her perspective, she wants equity instead of equality in terms of equal outcomes and Marxism, the oppressor versus the oppressed, and all of these isms. I mean, she has the black man agenda, which is fully racist and completely violates every notion of the Civil Rights Act and the Constitution. But all of these things that she wants the government to do, if she is actually elected, where does that leave not only the country, but the conservative movement and people who understand the foundings of America and want to rebuild the institutions? Where do we go from here after November 5th?
Well, it's a very difficult question. You know, we hear every time that this election is the most important election of your lifetime, and I am as sick of hearing it as everybody else. But there is a really serious crossroads that exists here. There is a kind of a tipping point from which one can't return. And that tipping point isn't necessarily ideological, though, as you point out, Harris is all of those things. She is terrible on all these issues. She doesn't believe, she obviously hates the country. She hates the people who are involved in the country. She is a puppet of the oligarchic class in the same way Joe Biden is. You know, she has some personal beliefs, I'm sure, but ultimately she spews whatever she's told to spew. But the really dangerous thing about Harris, beyond all of her ideological commitments, really is the fact that if she's here for 4 or 8 years, we're going to get completely open borders continuing. And the reason that matters, the reason that I highlight that issue over other ideological issues, which I do care about, which I do think are important, is that ultimately open borders are radically transforming the electoral situation in the United States, not to mention the cultural situation, the economic impact, language, everything else that it devastates, the murder rates, the traffic accidents, the drug peddling, all these things that are terrible, driving down wages, driving up home prices. But very importantly, just in pure power politics terms, when the borders are open, Kamala Harris knows she's importing voters. And they're doing it very specifically. You know, you just had Bill Clinton out stumping for Kamala Harris, accidentally saying, like, oh, well, since we aren't replacing ourselves, we need to replace you guys with new immigrants so that, you know, the welfare system doesn't collapse. Like, he's just saying what they believe. This is the plan. It's been the plan the whole time. Liberals will, you know, joke about it, laugh about it, brag about it. And then if someone notices that, they scream, oh, conspiracy theory, the great replacement. No, that's actually just the Democratic policy. And so if Kamala Harris allows another 4 to 8 years of completely open borders and immigration, what we're going to see is a seismic shift in the electorate. And while not every new immigrant is going to be a Harris supporter, a majority are, and they know this statistically, because they're the ones handing things out and letting people in, and that's just how politics works, whether we like that or not. And so ultimately what they're making sure is that they can just dilute the vote of existing conservatives. And so what's the most important thing for the conservative movement? It's got to be the end of this open border style immigration, because if it doesn't stop, then nothing else can get done. You care about, you know, different Christian issues, abortion, all these other issues. Well, guess who is the most stalwart opponent of all those things? It is American Christians, specifically white evangelicals, who are most likely to vote on those issues in the direction that conservatives desire. So when you are taking the country's population and diluting their vote specifically for the express purpose of making sure that you can stay in power as a Democrat, then all the other conservative issues end up not being as important, because how are you going to vote on them? How are you ever going to build a winning coalition when your opponent can literally just import voters until your vote doesn't matter?
Yeah, and this is exactly why the fundamental transformation of America is what I truly believe Kamala Harris and the Democrats' overall objective is. And whether Kamala Harris is just a puppet of the overall machine, or you know, exactly what role she plays in that with her word salad and, you know, vibes and joy and whatnot, That's clearly where they're going with this. And, you know, some of our friends, like Steve Dace, who's also there at The Blaze, Orrin McIntyre, where you're a host and writer as well, you know, he's been on this program frequently with me saying, you know, we may not have a country left if Kamala Harris gets in office for exactly some of the reasons that you're describing. I mean, no country can survive. I mean, because countries are defined by their borders, national sovereignty, a nation requires borders. If we just allow all of these people in who will come in and completely transform America and then just give the Democrats anything that they want, they're allowed to vote in our elections, all of those things. Do you think that Steve Dace is right that this may be the last election as we know it if Kamala Harris is in office?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely correct. Again, there is a point of no return. Look, you'll continue to have elections. Saddam Hussein holds elections, right? there's nothing magical about holding elections. The question is, do those elections actually represent the interests of the people? Do they actually reflect who, you know, the citizens of the country, what they believe, what they feel, what they value, who they want to represent them? If the thing that Democrats figured out is that the democratic mechanism, which is supposed to hold a certain percentage of our government accountable, can ultimately be hacked by changing the electorate itself. And currently, they are legitimizing, they're using the idea that popular sovereignty is legitimating agent of our government to get around the actual opinion of the people by importing new people with new opinions who will vote the way that they want, along with ballot harvesting, mail-in ballots, all the other changes that they've made. We used to be able to elect a president in one day. I'm getting older, but I'm not that old. I remember when we had this technology. Now we're talking, you know, the papers are already talking about the weeks it will take to know whether or not we have, you know, a legitimate presidential candidate. And the Democrats are already talking about how they won't certify Trump if he becomes elected, which is exactly the thing that, of course, Trump was criminally charged for supposedly having, you know, believed. And so ultimately, you're in the scenario where Democrats are making it very clear, we don't really have the intention of peacefully transferring power. And if we retain power, we intend to make sure that, you know, we don't ever end up in the situation again by, you know, completely changing the way elections work. So, yeah, technically we'll have elections, but in a meaningful sense, this could be the last one.
Yeah, and that's a great point that, you know, even banana republics hold elections, you know, and we put elections in air quotes. I mean, you know, Putin was elected, but, you know, it matters. Does this actually reflect the will of the people? And is it a free and fair election? And this is what conservatives are pushing for. And it's always the left that whether it's the Supreme Court, whether it's the legislature, whether it's elections, whatever the process is, they want to manipulate the rules just to get to their preferred outcome instead of playing by the rules and actually winning fairly. I mean, this is why Governor Tim Walz is suggesting that we should just tear down the Electoral College, because he doesn't want to play by those rules and actually give the entire nation a say. He wants to leave this to the urban populations of California and New York to just determine the outcome based on a popular vote, because that's in the best interest of Democrats, not actually democracy, which are two very, very different things. And so just in the last 2 minutes that we have in this segment, Orrin, what are you, out of all of this, what are you personally the most concerned about in terms of the future of conservatism if Kamala Harris is elected?
Well, you know, either way, I think the critical thing is that you have to build regional power. And we've seen this, we're both fans of Governor DeSantis in this area, both Floridians. And we've seen the power that this wields. You know, I just had a hurricane, blow through this area. Luckily, we were better off than most. It took a wiggle north before it hit us, and so we didn't get the eye of the thing. But, you know, we lost power for a day. There were already people on the ground, linemen lined up everywhere, emergency personnel prepared. You know, this was all ready to go the very minute it was safe for emergency personnel to be back on the ground. And that's because Ron DeSantis is an excellent governor, and he has everything together, and he knows how to organize, and he knows the essential need to build power at a regional level. And I think that needs to be the attitude for conservatives going forward, because if Kamala Harris is in charge, she is going to push down highly unconstitutional stuff. That's just going to happen. They're already doing it now, and they're going to, it's only going to get even worse. And as much as I love Ron DeSantis, and I think he is the model governor right now, even he has not been strong enough at pushing back against some of this. And so we need to see bold leadership from him and all the other Republican governors. You need to be pushing for Republican governors to get serious and challenge the federal government when they take rights away. Because if they're not standing between you and a tyrannical federal government, this is the doctrine of the lesser magistrate. They are supposed to protect their people from a tyrannical ruler.
Yeah, this is reviving federalism, perhaps, and understanding that the processes and procedures and powers embedded in our constitutional framework provide this type of pushback to federal government. So we're going to talk with Orrin McIntyre more and about what happens with conservatism if Trump gets elected when we come right back here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. Could the fate of America's children be tied to the fate of our nation itself? Much like the abortionists who end the lives of the unborn, the left is determined to undermine the pro-life movement. First, they target the babies. Then they come for the rest of us. Preborn stands as a beacon of hope for the most defenseless among us, preborn babies. Every day, Preborn's network of clinics rescue, on average, over 200 babies while surrounding expectant mothers with God's love and offering a free ultrasound. Rescuing the miracle of life has never been more crucial as we navigate this time of moral decline in our nation. Will you join Preborn in protecting the least among us? For just $28, you can sponsor an ultrasound and give a mother the chance to choose life, not only for her baby, but for herself. An ultrasound doubles a baby's chance at life. To donate securely, dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby. Or go to preborn.com. That's preborn.com/AFR. Preborn.com/AFR.
Speaking truth with love. This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Welcome back, and I'm joined by my very special guest, Orrin McIntyre, who is a host and writer at The Blaze, and we're talking about the future of conservatism as the overarching philosophy, not about Republican versus Democrat in terms of parties or, you know, what we love or hate as Christian conservatives about the GOP platform or the Democrat platform, which we can have all of those conversations. But the question, of course, heading into the 2024 election, which is just a little over 2 weeks away, is where does the future of our constitutional model and our supreme law of the land, our way of life, and our understanding and philosophy of American government go from here? And we talked in the last segment about the dangers of a Kamala Harris presidency to and an administration to safeguarding some of those very practical things like having borders and the importance of federalism and making sure that that some of these really good governors like Governor DeSantis is willing to push back against an overreaching federal government. So, Orrin, let's turn to the Trump side. I mean, arguably, for conservatives, obviously Trump is just better in terms of policy on things like the border, on things like bringing manufacturing and jobs, you know, back to the United States, understanding that America is a nation and comes first. That's his whole mantra of America first. So in terms of policy, but there are a lot of conservatives, whether, you know, Republican, independent or not, that are concerned with the MAGA brand of populism that has taken over the right side of the political spectrum in the United States, and are concerned with that clash, that if Trump is elected, then moving forward, conservatism may, well, in obviously the short term, America, I think, personally, will benefit from a Trump administration for by contrast of all of these things that we've talked about with Kamala Harris. But conservatism as an ideology will then have this clash with the type of populism that Donald Trump has advocated for and has really controlled within the GOP over the last 10 years. And this includes, you know, Gen Zers that have been brought up in politics under the Trump leadership model. And so conflate a lot of Trump's populism with the conservatism of you know, Buckley, Reagan, and, you know, some of these other, even Roger Scruton, you know, who wasn't an American, but wrote The Meaning of Conservatism. And so this ideological clash, where do you see potentially the pitfalls and where conservatism needs to go if Trump is elected?
You know, I might view Trump differently than you and some others. You know, I share your concerns with some of the ideological directions that Trump ultimately brings to the table. But the way I have always understood Trump, and I think the way that most people should understand Trump, is really Trump is a wrecking ball to the system. He's not himself an ideology. He's not himself some kind of moral vision that you can, you know, move in a certain direction with. Trump is there to shake up the system. And, you know, after what has been more or less 8 years under kind of the Trumpian influence, it's very easy. That's an entire political generation in a way. It's very easy for us to forget like what the Republican Party was before Donald Trump. So Donald Trump has brought real immigration reform to the front. He has brought the idea that we should care about the working class, care about American jobs, care about American economic sustainability. These are all things that the GOP did not care about previously. In fact, they actively pushed for basically open borders, for mass immigration, for the economic destruction of the United States. And let's not forget, of course, foreign wars, which were a massive part. The neocon grip on the Republican Party was highly influential. And now the majority of conservatives are against foreign adventurism. These are massive shifts in what the Republican Party believe. Now, I understand ultimately there are other shifts that people don't like about that, and I again share those concerns. But you know, the old quote from I believe Genghis Khan was, "Yeah, if you had not committed such terrible sins, God would not have sent me to destroy you." And I feel in a way that's kind of what Donald Trump is. Is he a good man? Is he the man of moral virtue that will ignite a revival in the United States? No, very obviously not. But is he in a way a judgment against the GOP, which was complacent and in many ways hostile to the well-being of its voters and many of the Christian conservatives who held that party aloft for generations but ended up doing nothing for them? Yeah, and I think in a way it is. So I think it's important to view Trump's role accurately, ultimately, in what's happening. And that doesn't mean you can't have real concerns about how that shapes the future of the party. But I think it's easy to forget what Trump has done up to this point, while we view and say, oh, well, but maybe I don't like parts of what is unfolding here, you know.
Yeah, and I agree with you to a certain point, and so I'll push back on this, and then you can tell me what you think of this. And I'm speaking with Orrin McIntyre, who is a host and writer at The Blaze. You can follow him on X. So I agree with you that Trump was the wrecking ball, especially in 2016, to a complacent GOP and to basically the whole rhino narrative of Republican in name only that's basically Democrat light. And this is why so many people loved what he accomplished in 2016, loved his messaging of just he was out there and he was willing to say what all of these other pretty politicians weren't willing to say. And that was all good. And you take a wrecking ball to a system that needs to be reshaped and rebuilt, and that's a good thing. But it's a good thing only to a certain extent if you don't rebuild in a way that is actually the model. And conservatism, when built on virtue, and liberty must be and outflowing from virtue and morality. My concern is that while Trump was a great wrecking ball, what the overall conservative and MAGA movement is rebuilding after that wrecking ball is more of a libertine populism rather than being built on, focused on moral values and truths. Like, for example, when Trump is basically right now abandoning the pro-life message, he's very much for the LGBTQ movement. He's for Amendment 3 here in Florida, which is to legalize not only recreational marijuana, but public use anywhere. And just like, yeah, you know, that's fine. And he doesn't, to your point, and I think you're absolutely right on on this. He doesn't actually stand for anything concretely. I think that he can be moved if he sees the transactional nature to his benefit for some other purpose. So you can't necessarily count on him to actually stand firm on really any issue. Because he is so transactional, and that's kind of the nature of his form of populism. So while the wrecking ball was good, I'm concerned about what the MAGA movement, especially the younger generation who hasn't really been brought up in the morality of the virtues of liberty and conservatism as a moral stance that's built in an objective biblical worldview, that what we are building under the banner of the MAGA movement is ultimately no better than the old Rhino model, just for vastly different reasons.
Well, ultimately, I think there is a difficult truth here that you are hitting on. And the truth is that, of course, Trump is a 90s Democrat. He always was. I hope that's not news to anyone. You know, the man's political beliefs really haven't shifted ultimately over the years. He's had more or less the same approach. Unfortunately, being like a pro-American Democrat is about as conservative as we could get at that time. That's an indictment of the movement. That's an indictment of the leadership of the movement. You know, there's a reason that Trump beat all the people who were standing on stage, and it's not because they were all extremely impressive. So, you know, should we be pursuing something better as a country? Yes, but ultimately, whether we like this or not, I think this is a reflection of where most of the country is. You point out, you know, Trump's support of many of the LGBT causes. I'm with you. I don't like that aspect of him. But let's be honest, the conservative movement was cheering people for purchasing children before Trump was ever nominated. You know, that was the direction that conservatism, quote unquote, was already going. And so I don't think that this is something unique to Trump. I don't think Trump drove the conservative movement this direction. I think this was the direction that conservatism was already heading anyway, because unfortunately it's getting further and further away from that organic virtue that you cited, which should be the core of what conservatism is protecting. But ultimately, while I do think the morality of our leaders matter, that's not where this change is going to come from. You know, the reason people are selecting Trump is because Trump does not actually clash with any of their current values. Maybe that's an indictment of Trump on some level, but it's a deeper indictment of the values that people hold if he doesn't. And so I think ultimately this change has to come from a lower scale understanding of community and virtue. And that is the only way in which we inculcate those beliefs to where that we then elevate them to a place where they are selection criteria for our political leaders. At the moment,
for sure.
I think
that this is an indictment ultimately of the church. I mean, and so many people are saying, oh, well, you know, we don't elect a pastor. And so, you know, it's perfectly fine to overlook all of these things that we disagree with or should disagree with as Christian conservatives with Trump. Ultimately, you're absolutely right. The moral virtue and returning to that virtue and a biblical worldview is not going to come from Donald Trump, and we know that. The issue is that the Christian conservatives are not holding the transactional nature of Donald Trump's populism to their favor. And we did, I think, in 2016. I mean, the only reason that Roe versus Wade was overturned, which, I mean, I'm incredibly grateful for, and I very proudly worked for Donald Trump, and I agreed with, you know, a lot of what he did in his administration. Now, was he perfect? Did I agree with everything? No. But, you know, you're never going to agree with anybody on those kinds. I mean, I've even disagreed with Governor DeSantis on things, as we've mentioned, and I think he's a fabulous governor, and that's why I moved to the state of Florida. So, but for all of those things, if the church and the Christian would engage more in policy, if we had the 35 million that Barna estimates are going of Christians who are going to sit out this election, if they would actually vote and Trump saw them as being a power player and needed their transaction, then we could bring that back from the despotism of that brand of populism that is void of a central objective moral truth. And so I agree with you that this isn't primarily Trump's fault. It is more the church in America that is acquiescing to this brand of MAGA. And so that's where the solution will come from. But I think I'm concerned with the overall just Trump is great and we can't criticize him at all, is that there is this new generation that's being brought up that really does separate moral virtue and biblical values and the church from politics, and they are pro libertine in a lot of ways that we're seeing the MAGA movement reshape the party of that's supposed to be of conservatism in a way that is not ultimately good for America. And so if Trump gets elected, what I would love to see, Warren, and you can tell me what you think about this as well, I would love to see the evangelicals be as much of the power brokers in terms of going to have a seat at the table and telling Donald Trump, listen, you know, here's everything that we bring to the table, but we want the policies that genuinely reflect a moral and upright society as our founders intended, because that's the only way we're going to sort of shift back from the MAGA brand of more of the libertarian, libertine populism that we see.
You know, I think there's an interesting phenomenon here because, you know, we both agree on the character of Trump and that it's not particularly conservative. But the thing that I see, and maybe, you know, it could just be my social sphere, my perception, but this is just my anecdotal evidence. The thing that I see in day in and day out is that many of the young people, especially the young people actually who are Trump supporters, are increasingly more devout, more religious than even their parents or grandparents. They are people who are rediscovering traditional Catholicism, Orthodox, returning back to their evangelical roots, going back to church in a very real way and taking it very seriously in a way that many of, let's be honest, their parents simply didn't do. They spouted the bromides about, oh, well, we need to have a Christian country or whatever, but they didn't put much of that into action. They didn't practice a lot of that. And so from what I see, even though a lot of these people are big Trump boosters, they are engaging with Trump in a way that is far more conservative, especially religiously oriented conservatism, you know, not free will, free market economics and endless war, but like actual values tied to the biblical worldview that you reference. And they understand that Trump is himself not the avatar of this, but they do use him as a rallying point for this. Now, there are also, you know, Trump is opening a larger tent, and that means that he is also, you know, attracting people who I agree, you know, I don't think ultimately hold conservative values and aren't interested in a more Christian nation. But that is, you know, two sides of that coin. And the question is, can we use that to our advantage or not? That's the dynamic. How do we properly wield it? And like you said, that means mm-hmm. being a player at the table. And I think that's important. That means that we need evangelical, specifically leaders that are serious. You know, I was at the National Conservatism Conference, and of course you have it's a put on by Yoram Herzoni, so there's a Jewish element, there's Catholics, and then there's Protestants. But the thing you notice about the Protestant element is it seems like the least organized, which I guess in some sense you would expect because it's Protestantism. It doesn't have that level of central organization that Catholicism does. But at the same time, that is a serious problem when it comes to political organization. And that means you also have to have specifically real political goals. So, for instance, when Roe versus Wade is overturned, I think a big shock for the conservative movement is that actually a lot of states wanted abortion. The citizens, that was their moral stance. That was their belief. And so when we actually return things in a federal style, like we've said we always wanted, back to the states, a lot of states returned it back to us and said, nope, we're good. Actually, we want Roe or worse. And that was a shock to a lot of conservatives who thought the battle was just we get rid of Roe and then abortion's gone. But that's not how it works. You have to make the case at the state level, as we've been advocating for. And a lot of people got angry and said, well, why isn't there immediately a federal ban? Well, maybe you can have that discussion. But you can't argue for federalism for 30-plus years, finally get to federalism, and just say you failed us because you didn't immediately deliver an anti-federal solution to this problem. Like that is just not the way that politics works, and everybody has to put on their big boy pants and say, okay, I understand that politics is give and take, and we won a huge thing, that is overall proven itself to be unpopular with certain states, and now we have work to do in those states with the people instead of saying, well, no, our first thing is to tell Trump, well, you failed us and we're not going to support you anymore. Like, and I'm not here to say you have to support Trump, like that this is your moral duty or whatever. That's not my point. My point is just if you're caring about political reality and winning and being a real player at the table, it means you have to have a certain level of discipline when it comes to how you apply political pressure.
Yeah, and I think that discipline and really lack thereof is what is extremely missing in the overall wider swath of the GOP or the right, however we want to frame that. And largely it's because I think we don't agree on the same goals and the same priorities. And we're seeing that even with, you know, how Mike Johnson is leading or trying to lead the coalition of Republicans in Congress right now, because his conference just doesn't agree. And unfortunately, unlike the Democrats who triage their priorities and then they all get behind for the most part what those are, Republicans generally don't do the same thing. And if at least evangelicals and conservatives would get behind those priorities and agree on the strategy and actually care more about winning than who gets the credit, as Ronald Reagan said, then we could probably accomplish a lot more, and we could at least have a bigger coalition and a stronger power play to then go to Trump and go to his administration and say, you know, here's what we want and here's what we can actually achieve and here's how we're going to do it and here's the money behind it. Because those are the types of things that somebody like him with the transactional nature that he just is. I mean, I saw it when I worked for him. That's the type of thing that Christians aren't doing, and it seems like all they're doing, to your point, Oren, that I agree with, is just criticizing without coming up with a solution. And you know, my mentor for years in law and policy, Mike Ferris, always said, if you're going to criticize, then have a solution and have an alternative that is practically achievable and implementing. So really fascinating discussion, and I really appreciate your time, Oren, and really good insights. Always appreciate it. And you can follow Oren McIntyre on social media and, of course, at The Blaze. And we will be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Speaking truth with love. This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Welcome back. And what a great conversation with Oren McIntyre. And this is why we need to go more deeply and substantively into an understanding of our system of government, not just here in America. I mean, obviously that matters because we are under the U.S. Constitution, which is unlike any other system of government in any political nation in world history and across the planet right now, but also to understand from an even deeper perspective the legitimacy of government that is predicated on the Judeo-Christian worldview. And this is what we talk about a lot on this program, what I talk about in my book, The Legal Basis for a Moral Constitution. And this is why when so many people write in, or, you know, and I love getting the comments on social media, like, you know, oh, you're on one hand, you're like praising Trump, and then on the other hand, you're criticizing him. And I can't really tell kind of, you know, where you're at. Well, that's because the objective moral standpoint is not to say if you support Donald Trump, then you have to agree with him 100% of the time. Or if I support Governor DeSantis, which I do, then I support every decision that he'll possibly make and I can't possibly criticize him. That's where we're getting to in a populist kind of mentality and this tribalistic sort of siloed view that if you support a particular politician, then you necessarily must agree with them 100% of the time, or you're disloyal, or you don't actually support them, or you're a flip-flopper or whatever. That is not the standard of truth that the Bible calls us to, because the standard of truth is the person of God and Jesus Christ. And so while we can, and a lot of people do, I have worked for various politicians in campaigns, and so you speak publicly what the campaign's position and that a candidate's position is, or that office holder, and that is your job. When we are Christians speaking just the objective truth of God, we need to contrast the worldview differences of Kamala Harris, Donald Trump, and everybody else down ticket with the objective moral standard, which is the word of God and the legitimacy of government that God himself describes in the Bible. And how do we do that? Well, we first have to know what the Bible teaches. This is why substantive theology matters. We have to understand what the truth is so that we can rightly divide truth from error. Because if we don't know what the truth is, how are we going to recognize error? We have to understand that first, and then we have to be consistent. And it doesn't mean that if we disagree, I mean, even on a lot of things with a certain politician, I am not of the belief that you have to agree 100% of the time or even 90% of the time or whatever percentage in a closed universe situation like elections. And there are a lot of people who are questioning, you know, can they vote in the presidential election? Because there are a lot of things like the abortion issue that we're talking about that Donald Trump, unfortunately, does not. It's not just that he doesn't agree with me or that my position, you know, is something that I'd like for him to change to reflect my view. It's that it is objectively the wrong stance. Now, can a Christian still vote for a candidate that is not pro-life? Some people in their conscience would say no. And I don't think that that is a wrong. I would never tell somebody, well, too bad, suck it up, vote anyway. The conscience verses in scripture, I think, speak very clearly to this, that you cannot violate your own conscience before the Lord. But I do think, on the other hand, the Bible also calls that person the weaker brother, right? To say, well, if you cannot engage in a closed universe situation and recognize that you only have two options in this election. I mean, yeah, can you vote a third party or write somebody? Sure. But it's either going to be Trump or Harris. I mean, that's just the reality of the math, right? And I don't even do math, but I know that much math. And it's going to be either Trump or Harris. And so you're going to have a closed universe situation. And even if you don't agree with 100% of what those candidates stand for, you can still execute your duty properly according to scripture, participate in the vote by voting for the best or the better option among your alternatives. And that's called a wisdom decision, because you may not have, I mean, in all kinds of situations in life, we may not have the perfect solution or the perfect option, but you make the best decision you can at the time with the information that you have at the time. And it's called wisdom. And we need to be praying for the best possible outcome for America. And regardless of whether it is Trump or Harris, I think that conservatism overall, and especially the church, has a lot of introspection to do, because we need to get away from a standard of, you know, MAGA or Trump or what the difference that he articulates between loyalty, disloyalty, whatever, to getting back to a standard of truth. And now, I have been someone who has very much applauded Trump. I worked for him. I know him personally. And I've also criticized him before and after I've worked for him. And that's because my standard ultimately is the truth of my Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. And we can do that, but we also need to offer solutions. And so when I criticize things about Trump or even Harris, or when I say that maybe Kamala Harris said something that, you know, that was right, it's not because I'm then saying, okay, therefore I agree with 100% of what she says, or if I disagree with Trump, you know, he's 100% wrong on everything. It's that we have to look at every single policy perspective and align that and rightly divide truth from error, align it with the standard and say, does that comport with the objective biblical standard or not? And that's not infighting. It's not criticizing them personally. It's not, you know, saying anything about anything other than that particular policy stance. And that's true for every elected official. It's true for every ballot measure. And so the church, by and large, and what I hope that you have gleaned from this conversation today, is that the meaning of conservatism needs to be founded in and grounded in objective truth and a biblical standard moving forward, so that we are not teaching, especially our new Gen Z generation coming up, that the libertine populism can be true for politics and then the biblical worldview is only for church and inside church, because that is a complete disorganized conflicted worldview, and we have to be consistent. And so regardless of whether Trump or Harris is elected, I am confident that if every Christian prays for the future of our country, God will hear our prayers. He establishes and ordains leaders. And whether or not that is Trump or Harris, we can, as a church, individually and in community, collectively as the ecclesia, move forward, fulfill the Great Commission, which is teaching the truth of God and the gospel of Christ. And we can have a better form of conservatism based on those biblical principles that we really, really need to reestablish and reground ourselves in, regardless of who is in the White House come January 20th of 2025. Pray for our country. Get out and vote your values, which should be truth. And you can always reach me and my team, Jenna at AFR.net. And don't forget to listen to On Demand with Jenna Ellis at AFR.net. We'd like to thank our sponsors, including Preborn. Preborn has rescued over 200,000 babies from abortion, and every day their network clinics rescue 200 babies' lives. Will you join Preborn in loving and supporting young moms in crisis? Save a life today. Go to preborn.com.